WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. One thing is pretty clear in this world. If you can get Elizabeth Warren and Steve Bannon to agree on something, and the something is that you're doing a lousy job and you can't be trusted, that's kind of a feat. And that's where the big four tech companies are right now. Google, Apple, Amazon, and Facebook are among the biggest and most profitable companies in the world, and they've been accustomed to having their way in Washington for a very long time. But maybe not anymore. The Department of Justice, the Federal Trade Commission, and Congress are all investigating the tech giants, and there's now talk that antitrust laws could be applied to break them up. Elizabeth Warren has actually made that a cornerstone of her campaign.
They think they can run their business to just roll right over every small business, every entrepreneur, every startup that might threaten their position. It is time to break up America's tech giants.
I asked Sue Halpern, who reports for us on technology and politics, whether Washington is finally changing its tune.
Basically, we've got a situation in which the tech giants have done a number of things that are wrong and creepy, the last of which was the Nancy Pelosi fake video that made her look like a drunken fool.
And then he had a press conference in the Rose Garden with all this short sort of visuals that obviously were planned long before I said most currently that he was engaged in a cover-up.
And the response in there, in that case of Facebook, was, oh, sorry, let's move on. When the Pelosi video was not taken down, one of the things that Facebook said was, well, we don't have a rule that says everything on our platform has to be true. And so there's been a lot of talk among constituents, among politicians, that this has got to stop.
So what would have to happen for Congress to determine that these big tech companies are, in fact, huge monopolies or that they're acting anti-competitively?
Well, that's actually, David, that's one of the problems, is the antitrust laws that we have on the books are really not set up to deal with these companies, in part because antitrust is typically about pricing. It's typically about, you know, is someone controlling the market and making things, you know, cost a particular thing, and that's not what's happening here. So that, I think, one of the things they could possibly do is change the antitrust statutes. Breaking them up doesn't solve the problem of privacy, and it doesn't solve the problem of data surveillance, and it doesn't solve the problem of propaganda, you know, and those are some of the biggest issues, and those are some of the issues that are really, you know, driving a lot of people's disapproval of these companies.
What was the turning point, do you think? In other words, for years and years, it seemed to me that Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Apple were revered, really revered for their imagination, the facility of these inventions, the way they seemed to make life easier and more seamless and fluid. and then something happened. What was the turning point?
I think the turning point was pretty recently, and I think it came with two things. One was the 2016 presidential election, where we saw platforms like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram being used to project and inject propaganda into the country that was very divisive. I think people were very disturbed by the fact that there were possibilities of using tools on Facebook to suppress the African American vote. And the second thing to sort of, you know, kick it down the road was Cambridge Analytica, when suddenly, you know, 87 million Facebook user profiles were being harvested. What Cambridge Analytica did was really not that much different than what the Obama campaign was doing in 2012 with you know, data from the friends of users. But suddenly it was looked on as this very dark exercise, which it was.
Well, and then why did the Obama campaign get away with it, as it were, and not the Trump campaign?
Because I don't think people, first of all, I don't think anyone really knew about it. Second of all, the scale was much, much different. And third of all, they weren't doing it for the dark arts. They weren't doing it to try to suppress the vote. They were doing it to try to get people to get out to vote. So I think there wasn't a sense that, you know, something untoward was going on. You know, the surprising victory of Donald Trump led people to ask the question, what happened? They really mastered the tools that Facebook had put out there. And they weren't put out there exclusively for the Trump campaign. They were put out there for anybody.
How do you go about even remotely going against the problem of privacy?
So
the privacy that none of us really have.
Yeah. So one of the issues here is that there are really no laws that protect our data and protect us from the acquisition of our data and the sale of our data and the use of our data in these advertising platforms, which is what Facebook and Google really are. So we could follow the lead of Europe and start legislating privacy laws that cover these things. And that's happening to an extent in the states. And that's what's been really interesting to watch. So you see California has a pretty stringent privacy law that's about to go into effect, or might have already gone into effect, that pretty much follows the GDPR.
The GDPR being the European law on data privacy.
Yeah. And one of the things that's been really interesting to watch is the extent to which the big tech companies are now calling for regulation, but they're calling for federal regulation because they're looking at the states and they're getting worried that the states are going to do things that are much more stringent than anything that they and their lobbyists can get the federal government to do. So it's a very interesting moment where you see these tech giants coming back and saying, oh, no, no, we really want to be regulated. But the fact is they want to write the regulations.
Well, ultimately in Washington, is there real support for the kind of European laws that they have on privacy?
There's probably not a lot of support for the more stringent controls that they have.
Why? What's the downside?
Well, the downside is that there's a kind of longstanding, deep-seated allergy to regulation. I mean, we get that definitely from the right and from the left, or, you know, let's say from the Republicans, there's the anti-regulatory sensibility. And from the Democrats, they've always looked at tech with that kind of starry-eyed, you know, these are our children kind of sensibility.
Not just our children, but our big contributors.
Well, that I was going to go there. Yes, no. Absolutely. So for the longest time, they were getting a lot of money from the tech companies from Silicon Valley.
How freaked out or not are these tech companies about the hearings in Congress this week? Are they seeing this as an existential threat to their companies, or are they so well defended by lawyers and lobbyists and the rest that they're pretty confident that they'll survive it?
I think both. I mean, I think that the reason why they're so well defended by their lawyers, and they do have lots and lots of antitrust lawyers in their companies, and, you know, they're looking at this as a moment in which they're being called to account. They have to do something, but they want to direct the conversation. They want to direct how it goes so that ultimately they still win.
Well, there were hearings in the House earlier this week, and lawmakers started examining the power of Amazon and Apple and Alphabet, which is Google's parent, and Facebook. So what's changed politically that made investigations possible? Just one outrage after another?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's been very, very clear that the regulatory agencies that are overseeing the tech companies aren't overseeing the tech companies. The FTC has been unbelievably toothless in its regulation of tech. I mean, look at what happened with Facebook. In 2011, it had them sign a consent decree that basically Facebook said, yep, we have been taking data from people who don't know that we're taking it, but we're not going to do it again. And then they did it again. They did it in such a huge, big way. You know, we found out about Cambridge Analytica, and that's just, you know, one thing that they did. And now, you know, what is it, 8 years later, they're finally getting around to talking about fining Facebook. That is a very, very slow wheel of justice. And so there's a desire on the part of legislators to try to figure out whether or not they can do something legislatively. And that really does remain to be seen.
But finally, who are the people in government who can have the biggest impact on big tech? Is it the FTC? Is it the Justice Department? A certain House committee? Or is it the presidential candidates?
Good question. I think that, you know, one of the things that we know is that there antitrust can come from either the FTC or from the Department of Justice. You know, what can the presidential candidates do? And obviously, all they can do is talk. But one of the things that happens when they talk, when Elizabeth Warren talks about breaking up big tech, she automatically puts the tech companies on the defensive, and then they have to come up with a rationale for why they shouldn't be. And then we have a conversation. And I think, you know, that's the beginning of any of this, is to have this in the public domain, because it's not going to happen if we just, you know, say, oh, well, you know, they're too big. You know, they're too big not only to fail, they're too big to succeed. And then we just move on.
Sue Halpern is a frequent contributor to The New Yorker and a scholar in residence at Middlebury College. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks for joining me. If you read anything about American history and politics, you've got to know the name Robert Caro. He's written about two politicians, just two, but both of them were masters in the art of wielding power. The first book was about Robert Moses, the city planner who shaped modern New York more than any human being. Then Caro began to write about Lyndon Johnson, who signed much of the key progressive legislation of the 1960s, but also presided over the disaster in Vietnam. Caro has already published 4 volumes on Johnson's life, with a 5th to come, and that book will cover the crucial years of the presidency. But to call those books mere biographies kind of misses the mark. They're so rich in detail, so accurate, and at the same time so broad in scope and dramatic that they're more like epics of American life. Robert Caro himself has become a kind of legend among nonfiction writers. We all talk about him all the time, and he's just published a book called Working, and it's a gift. It's a collection of interviews and essays that talk about the craft of what he does. Robert Caro and I sat down to talk recently at the McCarter Theater in Princeton, New Jersey. I want to start at the beginning, Bob. Your first job out of college was as a reporter at the New Brunswick Daily Home News. And I'd like to know what you thought you were getting into, what you thought your life would be like as a newspaper reporter, what you wanted out of that job, where you thought you were going.
Well, I didn't know it. Wherever I thought I was going, wherever I thought I was going wasn't where I found myself. So the New Brunswick Home News then was tied in with the Middlesex County Democratic machine. In fact, it was tied in so closely that the chief political reporter was given a leave of absence each election season so he could write speeches for the Democratic organization. So I had just gone to work there, and he got a minor heart attack. But he wanted to be able to get that job back when he recovered, so he picked as a substitute the guy he thought would be most inept. And I went to work for the New Brunswick Home News, for the Middlesex County Democratic machine, and I fell in with a very tough old political boss in New Brunswick. And for some reason, he took a shine to me, and he took me with him everywhere. And every time I'd write a speech for one of his candidates, mayor or city council that he liked, he'd take out this wad of $50 and $100 bills. My salary at the time was $52.50 a week. And he'd peel off quite a few bills and hand them to me. And I really liked that aspect of the job. But then, do you want me to tell you how I left the job?
I do.
Yeah. So the following thing happened sort of by accident, but it did in a way shape my life. So on election day was coming up, and he said, do you want to ride the polls with me? I didn't even know what riding the polls meant. But that day he picked me up in his big limousine, and instead of his usual driver, there was a police captain drove the car. I didn't understand why. But then what we were doing is going from pole to pole, and at each pole, a police officer would come over to the car, and the boss and the captain would roll down their windows, and they'd get a report on that polling place. Generally, the report was, everything's under control here. But we drove up to one polling place, I can see it to this day, and there was a police paddy wagon there, and the police were herding into it a group of very well-dressed, young, all African-American demonstrators. They weren't pushing or shoving them, but they were moving their nightsticks to herd them into the paddy wagon. And all of a sudden, I just couldn't stand it. And I knew I just wanted to get out of that car. As I remember it, I didn't say a word. And I don't remember the boss saying a word. The next time the car stopped at a light or something, I just opened the door and got out. I felt he must have seen how I felt, because he never said a word. But I went back and I told Ina, my wife, who's here somewhere tonight, I've got to find a newspaper. I've got to find a newspaper that fights for things. So I made a list of what I considered crusading newspapers. And
well, who was on that list at that time?
Well, Newsday, that I went to.
The Long Island newspaper. Yeah,
the St. Louis Post. Well, I'm not sure I can remember the whole list. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch, I remember, was on it. But Newsday.
So you got to Newsday, which it seemingly was a job of your dreams. And one of the things you did, as I recall, you wrote a six-part series on a proposed bridge that was going to really dig into every ramification, political, financial, environmental, on this bridge in the New York area. Could you tell that story? Because it seemed to play a pivotal role in your career.
So Robert Moses wanted to build a bridge across Long Island Sound between Rye and Westchester County and Oyster Bay on Long Island. Newsday assigned me to look into it, and I discovered it was just the world's worst idea because it would have generated so much traffic from New England that the Long Island Expressway would have needed, as I recall, 12 additional lanes just to handle that traffic. And Newsday sent me up to Albany, and everybody seemed to understand that this was a terrible idea. So I wrote a story saying basically the bridge was dead, and I went on to other things. So I had a friend in Albany then, and about 2 weeks later, he calls me and he says, Bob, I think you better come back up here. And I said something like, oh, I don't think so. I think I took care of that bridge.
My work here is done.
Yeah. And he said, well, Robert Moses was up here yesterday, and I think you ought to come back up. And I came back up, and I saw Nelson Rockefeller and Rockefeller's council and the speaker. And they now thought this was the world's best idea. And not only that, the state was going to pay for getting it started. So I remember driving home from Albany that night. It was 163 miles to my home in Roslyn. And all the way down, David, I was thinking, everything you've been doing is basically baloney. Because underlying everything that you do on politics is the belief that we live in a democracy. And in a democracy, power comes from being elected, from our votes at a ballot box. So here was a man, Robert Moses, who had never been elected to anything, but he had more power than a mayor and governor put together. And he had held this power for 44 years, almost half a century, and with it he had shaped New York City. He built 627 miles of parkways and expressways, every modern bridge in New York, reshaped the whole park system, etc. And I didn't have any idea where he got the power to do this, and I realized, driving home that night, neither does anybody else. And that was really the genesis of the power program.
That power is something invisible to even the most entrepreneurial newspaper reporter.
Nobody had ever explored in any depth whatsoever where he got this power from.
Were there biographies? Were there books? Were there things that you were reading that impressed you as a potential model?
Well, I don't know that any impressed me as a potential model, because what I was thinking, what my next thought was, well, you can do so much of it. If you manage to find out where Robert Moses got this power, you will be teaching that no one knows now where he gets that power. You will be learning something and teaching some about political power. So at first I actually thought I was going to do it as a long series, you know. And then I said, you just said, no, I can never do this as a series. It has to be a book. So I, at that time, knew only one editor in the entire world, in the book world. So I wrote him a letter, and I got what I call the world's smallest advance to do a biography of Robert Moses.
Enough time has elapsed, so who was the editor, and what was the advance?
I'd rather not say who was the editor. The advance was
$5,000. $5,000.
Of which they gave you $2,500 in advance.
So you went to town. Now, at a certain point in your research, you had a meeting with some of the public relations guys that were around Robert Moses. What happened?
Well, they said to me, you know, many people, some famous writers, had started doing biographies of Robert Moses, but none had ever done one. And I guess it was said to them pretty much what they said to me. You know, they worked as a team, that you never just, because the more, they take you to lunch and they said, well, you know, Commissioner Moses will never talk to you. His family will never talk to you. His friends will never talk to you. And then they had a phrase, David, I can't remember the exact wording, but the import was, anyone who ever wants a contract from the city or state will never talk to you.
So they weren't being very subtle.
It wasn't very subtle at all. Yeah, no.
In fact, it sounds pretty threatening. What was the mood of the meeting?
It was, you're going to waste your life if you try to do this.
And so you leave that meeting thinking what?
Well, I knew by that time I was going to do the book. but I had to figure out a way to get to interview these people. So what I did actually was I drew a series of concentric circles on a piece of paper. And in the center, I put a dot. The dot was Robert Moses, and the innermost circle was his family, and then the next one, his friend. So I said, well, maybe he can stop everyone in the first few circles from talking to me, but he won't be able to remember all the people that he's dealt with in the outer circles. I'll start with them.
Now, why do you think that he eventually wanted to see you? Because he felt the hot breath of the reporter getting closer?
Well, you know, I've never known the answer. You ask terrific questions. I've never known the answer to that question. His chief deputy, a guy named Sidney Shapiro, who I became friendly with over the years, told me years later something, well, it's very complimentary to me, but this is the only explanation I ever got. He said that Commissioner Moses, they all called him Commissioner all the time, had realized that finally someone had come along who was going to do the biography, whether he wanted it or not. Mm. I don't know if that's true or not.
And, you know, something that, maybe you disagree with me, but Robert Moses was not the subject of countless books at that time.
No.
Attention, political attention on the front page of newspapers went elsewhere to office holders, world leaders, and all the rest.
Exactly.
He did not hold an exalted seeming office.
No.
Is it possible that he was, in some perverse way, flattered by your attentions?
No.
I gave it my best try. Some people wield political power, they're in it for the money. Some people are in it for, possible foreign business opportunities after they leave office.
Yeah.
other people are in it because they have colossal egos that we can't even begin to understand. What was Robert Moses in it for?
Robert Moses was in it to build his dreams. You know, as a young man, he did wonderful things, and his dreams were incredible. He would tell me these stories about thinking of the West Side Highway and Riverside Drive, and you'd sit there just enraptured by his, and you saw this was a guy who had this great dreams. And he, when he's young, he doesn't know how to accomplish them because he's an idealist. But he learns how to accomplish them by using power. And then he changes. So his dreams, I think I have a phrase like this in The Power Broker, were no longer for ideals, but they're for whatever increment power could give him. And so he starts to build the different kinds of projects. So the story of his, You looked at his life. I remember thinking, how did this one man turn into this other man, this idealist who just wanted to dream dreams? How did he turn into this guy who controlled city and state and really destroyed whole neighborhoods in New York for his parkways?
One of the things that so fascinates me about this book and the writing of it is that at a certain point, Bob, you think of the last line of the book, hundreds of pages before you get there, and you write toward it. Tell me about that.
So Moses had long since stopped talking to me, you know, but I would go...
And forgive me, but just to put a pin in that, why did he cut off communications with you?
Why? Because I asked him the wrong... Robert Moses built a Northern State Parkway out into Long Island. And I found the original maps, and the parkway was a straight line right through the states of the great robber barons of the 1920s. But that's not how the road runs. In two places, the road suddenly dips down about 3 miles before it comes back to the other route. I couldn't understand why that happened. And then I came across a letter in Franklin Roosevelt's papers which explained it, which was that the legislature, which was controlled by these robber barons, was stopping Moses from building the Northern State Parkway by cutting off his funds. And they wouldn't even give him money for surveys. The Northern State Parkway was supposed to run right across the private 18-hole golf course of a financier named Otto Kahn. And Otto Kahn said, I'll give you, not to him, but to the Long Island State Parkway, I'll give you $10,000 for surveys if the surveys find a route around my golf course. So Moses accepted the money. So he had to move it south almost 4 miles, as I recall. So, I have the story. But I'm looking at these maps, and the route that it finally takes on the bottom of that bottom estate, there are 23 little dots. But I realized they must be little farms. So I said to Ina, you know, I wonder, let's try to find a couple of these farmers. And so I found a man named, who had been named as a boy, Jimmy Roth, and his mother, and they told me the story, how they had bought this farm. It was so filled with stumps of with trees and rocks that it was not arable. And they finally got the farm so that the center portion was clear. And then one day, right then, a representative of Robert Moses shows up and says that the Long Island State Park Commission is condemning the middle part of your farm, the good part of your farm, for the Northern State Parkway. And Jimmy said to me, I remember my father pleading with this man, if he just moved the parkway 400 feet south, we could make the farm pay. If he took it right out of the center of the farm, the farm would never work for us. And he said, you know, my father's life was ruined by this. Now, I knew that, in fact, the road ran through his farm only because Robert Moses had bowed to the power and the money of the Otto Kahns and the J.P. Morgans. And I remember thinking, so you're doing this book, you're writing about the guy who has power. You haven't even thought about writing in detail about the people who have no power and what power does to them.
And then at the end, that final line...
Oh, I'm sorry, I
is
forgot
about, but No. But it goes to this. At the end, you're writing about someone who couldn't quite understand why he was not universally loved and adored.
Yes. That, so the last line of the book is, why weren't they grateful?
That's Robert Caro, talking about the city planner Robert Moses, the subject of his Pulitzer Prize-winning biography, The Power Broker. I'll be back with Robert Caro in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So, if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and if you're just joining us, I'm talking today with Robert Caro. Caro's already published 4 volumes of his biography of Lyndon Johnson. The next book, the fifth, will have to be the most ambitious, as it takes in the triumphs of civil rights, and the disaster of Vietnam.
So, Bob, documents are essential, interviews are essential, and there's another thing that seems absolutely essential to your work, and that is living and breathing the physical environment. It seems revelatory to you. I will never forget the experience in the 80s of picking up Volume 1 of Johnson and reading about the Hill Country, about the physical environment in which he grew up, and electrification that came later. All this stuff is absolutely thrilling, which would seem routine usually in a nonfiction book. You and Ina moved to Texas.
Yeah.
And you didn't just go for a tourist week or two. You were there for a long time. When you interviewed Sam Houston, the brother of Lyndon Johnson, sure, you interviewed him a bunch of times at first, but he turned out to be a kind of, I don't know, guy who bragged and drank a hell of a lot. And it really, you did this amazing thing of bringing him to a replica of the childhood home of the Johnson brothers. And that had an effect, too. Can you talk about that?
Yes, well, you summed it up very well. You know, of course, Lyndon Johnson's brother, his younger brother, was one of the first people, and I spent a lot of time with him. And basically, you know, he was a big drinker, as you said, and a lot of the stuff that he said was exaggerated or false, you know.
Or he had repeated a million times before.
Or he'd repeat these anecdotes that everybody told, and they were part of every biography on Lyndon Johnson, which portrayed him as sort of a Horatio Alger figure, you know, popular, charismatic, who rose to power. By this time, I knew that whatever the secret was that drove Lyndon Johnson to this desperate ambition, you know, that everybody talks about, whatever that was came out of this relationship with his father. So I thought of a way to try to put Sam Houston back in the mood where he would tell the true story. So I asked the National Park Service, could I bring him in to the Johnson Boyhood Home, which is recreated just the way accurately, after the tourists were gone for the day. So we went in there about dinner time, and I took him into the dining room. It was a plank table with two benches, you know. So the father sat in a high back chair at one end, the mother at the other end. Then on one side are the three Johnson sisters, Lyndon's three sisters. On the other side are Lyndon and Sam Houston. So I said to Sam Houston, sit down in the place you sat as a boy. And I didn't sit where he could see me because I wanted him to feel he was back at his boyhood home. I sat behind him. So I said, now tell me about these terrible arguments that your father used to have with Lyndon at the table. And at first it was very slow going, you know, you'd have to keep prompting him. But finally, he was just shouting it out. Lyndon, you're a failure, you'll always be a failure. And what are you? You're a bus inspector, you know. And I felt he was back in the moment. So I said, now Sam Houston, I want you to tell me again those wonderful stories that you told me before, and that everybody tells about Lyndon Johnson. And there was this long pause, and then he says, I can't. And I said, why not? And he says, because they never happened. And without me saying another word, he starts to tell the story of Lyndon Johnson, which is a very different story of a very ruthless young man that's in my book. And this time, when I went back to the other people involved in the anecdotes, they said, yes, that's what happened, and would tell me more details.
Incredible. Incredible. And it's almost as if your work extends to the psychoanalytic in some way. No kidding around. That, but by coming back and back and listening, that you get to a level of revelation that just is far deeper than you would even dream of.
People get so angry at me because I interview them over and over again, and I say, but if I was standing there next to you, what would I see? You know, they get really angry. I told you what I would see. I was standing in the Oval Office and Lyndon Johnson was walking around, and you say, well, what would I see? So I'll tell you one example of what that can do. Joe Califano was Johnson's chief domestic advisor. So he was telling me about a crisis in the Oval Office, and Califano said he was there, and Lyndon Johnson was walking around, and I said, well, what did he say? I told you, Bob, he was walking around. What do you want me to tell you?
You want him to work harder for you, in a sense.
Well, yes. And I said, well, what exactly was he doing? And it took me asking this several times. I said, well, you know, there was something, you know. It was like Lyndon Johnson was so hungry for the news, for the late, there were three tickers, the Associated Press, the United Press, and Reuters, that he had in his corner of the Oval Office. And he said he would go over and read it. And I said, well, that's just great, Joe. But what would I see when he was reading it? I don't recall exactly what he said to me, but he was annoyed. And I said, no, Joe, what would I see? And then he said, oh, you know, there was something. It was like he couldn't wait to see the next line of the news. So he'd bend down and he'd take the ticker tape in both hands as if he was trying to pull it out of the machine faster. So you say, it was worth getting Califano angry at me.
Now, one of your principles as a writer, and it's rooted in your, in a sense, rejection of your life as a newspaper reporter or transcendence of it, is not to speed up, but to slow down. Your process seems to be one of bucking the modern world. You I've been to your office. It has a typewriter, a bunch of very modern file cabinets. I think there was a bulletin board.
Yeah.
No research assistants, no armies of extras. It's you and very often Ina working on your behalf of, and on these projects, and that's it. Tell me about slowing down.
Your question, how do I, the slowing down thing was something that I learned here at Princeton when I was an undergraduate. I took creative writing courses here for 2 years. So the creative writing professor then was a critic, R.P. Blackmer, then very famous, now people have forgotten him. And every 2 weeks you handed in a short story. And the way I was at Princeton, I was always doing things at the last minute. But I always got pretty good marks with him, and I thought I was fooling him. Then the second year, in my very last time, I handed in a short story. He handed it back, and he said something complimentary. And then, as I'm getting up to leave, he says, but you know, Mr. Caro, you will never achieve what you want to achieve unless you learn to stop thinking with your fingers. And as do you ever feel that someone's seen right through you all the time when you thought you were fooling him? He knew that I hadn't put much thought into these stories.
Now, I probably think it's for the best that we've talked almost completely about Robert Moses and LBJ, but we are living in a political moment. And when you watch the current president, it seems that one of the saving graces is that for all his erratic thinking, insulting thinking, his insults directed at minority groups and, well, practically everyone, that he's not that good at the exercise of power. He won the election, but if he had Johnsonian capacities in terms of the exercise of power, we might be even in deeper trouble than we already are.
Well, I think that that's correct. And I think it's, you know, when you say at a Johnson, what does it mean to have a Johnson, you know? You say, well, he wins election over Barry Goldwater in 1964 by this tremendous majority. So the next morning, he's on the phone, or the morning after, he's too hoarse the day of the election, calling the House Majority Leader and saying, you know, the only thing that can hold us up here is the Rules Committee. Now is the moment to change the Rules Committee. Here's how to do it. And in the next couple of months, he passes Medicare, Medicaid, Head Start, the Voting Rights Bill. I'm forgetting the rest of it. The most amazing, so he could seize a moment because of this political genius that he has. And change really the face of America. It's hard to remember a day when there wasn't Medicare and Medicaid.
You write in Working that there is, evil and injustice that can be caused by political power, but there's also great good that can come out of it. It seems to me sometimes that people have forgotten this, you write. Why have we forgotten it?
Well, you ask very good questions. I think we've forgotten it because we've had too many presidents who don't use political power for... You say, what are things that change people's lives, you know, in last century? Social Security, Medicare. Like right now, I'm working on a section that you could say, if I wanted to call it this, is what was it like to be old and sick in America before Medicare? And as I'm doing this, I'm thinking, people aren't going to be able to imagine this. What was it like to be old in America before Social Security? People can't imagine it. The power of government to do good for people is immense. And I think we have forgotten that power.
Robert Caro, thank you. Robert Caro, the winner of every prize under the sun, 2 Pulitzers, National Book Awards, you name it. We spoke last month at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton, New Jersey. His new book is called Working, and his 5th volume on the life of Lyndon Johnson is in progress. Don't rush him. Now, summer is here, although in Houston, Texas, it's been well into the 90s for weeks.
Right now, it's a little bit past 6, and it is sufficiently swampy. Yeah, and it's pretty disgusting outside, actually. But I think that's just what we've got to work with until July-ish, and then it'll only get swampier, and then it'll disappear around November.
Brian Washington is a Houston native and a writer of short stories. His debut collection of stories is set among Houston's hustlers and drug dealers, and it's gotten great reviews. We published his short story called Waw in The New Yorker in 2018. When Brian Washington got back from his book tour recently, he took us to one of his favorite places, the West Alabama Ice House. And the truth is, if you don't know what an ice house is, you probably don't live in Houston.
I think the idea of an ice house is really debatable, and I think the only consistency with everyone's definitions is that there really is no one true definition of what an ice house is. Some folks would argue that it has to have been a place that literally sold ice at some point in time. Some people could argue that an ice house's signifier is shitty parking to sort of accentuate the fact that it's a community hub and people from the community would walk over and just hang out. Some people would argue that an ice house had to have originally served as a sort of convenience store, because that's how many ice houses started out, and that they sold ice, you know, they sold milk, they sold bread, because it was a place that could keep those things cool. I think it's literally different from a regular bar in that swaths of it are outside and swaths of it are populated by benches, and the ice house doesn't sell liquor either. They sell beer, they sell cider, they sell water, they sell sodas, but they don't sell hard liquors. That's just not something that they do. So if you were walking from off the road, like you're just walking to the ice house from off the street, you're gonna run right into some benches. You might stub your toe on one of them as you head your way to the bar. And if you turn the corner, there's a bit of an awning with a series of TVs, or most folks are watching whatever basketball game. Right now it's the playoffs.
Dude, they're just so inconsistent getting them to show up.
I know that one chicken truck was very inconsistent, but it's summertime now. We need to get it going.
You know I want to eat.
Well, I think the concept of the ice house started in the late 1800s, because you had these ships that were coming down from Maine to the Gulf of Mexico, and they would stop over in Galveston, and that's where they would unload and sell the ice that they had left over. And in the years since, at least West Alabama Ice House has trend, like there's a tamale guy right there, like he's selling like fucking tamales. So that's maybe an allusion to the different kind of things that you could buy in a space
tamales,
like
tamales,
this.
Tamales, I'm selling tamale guys, tamales.
I first started coming to the Ice House because it was a meeting place or a sort of nexus point, because like the first time I was hanging out in Montrose, I had never been in this neighborhood before, so I was just still exploring it, mostly just like gay clubs and gay bars around the area, and it was a great place to meet people because everyone knew where it was. So it served as a sort of landmark, so you could pregame and get a beer or whatever for significantly cheaper than you would at whatever bar or club that you were going to, and then just go off and enjoy your evening. So it served as a sort of introduction to the neighborhood in this part of town for me, and it's sort of remained in my life since then.
What's up? How are you doing?
How are you?
Pretty good. Can I get a Bohemia and then can we also get a Topo Chico?
But I've had like not great experiences in ice houses as well. You know, I've gotten kicked out of this particular ice house like twice. The first time that I got kicked out, I was just hanging out with some friends and we were sitting next to a table and there was like this group of like burlier white guys and they were talking very loud and one of them was pretty virulently homophobic, which now I would not have the reaction that I did then, but as someone who had just like come out a few years ago, I hadn't had too many contacts with like blatant open homophobia. So I picked a fight, and it was like, I say kicked out, but that's a bit of a euphemism. It's not like it's a movie where we were literally thrown out, but you know, the bartender came over and they like shoot us out, and like that was my end of, you know, the end of my relationship with the Ice House for a few months or, you know, a little while. The other time I broke up with someone, but yeah, we had a pretty significant argument being, you know, right before we were asked politely to leave. Yeah.
I'm not a DJ though. Yasha, what do you want to hear?
I'd say these days I'm here about once or twice a week. And if I'm here like on a weekend, let's say, then I'm probably working on something. So I'll have my laptop and I'll just edit whatever I need to edit or just work on emails or whatever for a few hours. And then inevitably I'll end up people watching and just sort of gelling in with the Ice House itself, whatever the vibe is that particular day. There have been times where I've been here and there have been like wedding parties, let's say, and they've asked me to like sit with them. Like they might have like too much beer or they might have too much food, and you end up talking to people and you get swept up in whatever the excitement is. It's a space where I've just like lived here, you know, sort of run through the spectrum of emotions, and I can't think of too many places outside of like an actual home or an actual workplace where that would be the case.
Brian Washington at the West Alabama Ice House in the Montrose neighborhood of Houston. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for joining me today. And I just want to mention that if you missed our program last week, I'd love it if you would give it a listen. Masha Gessen joined me to put 50 years of gay rights since the Stonewall Uprising into proper context. And I'm really proud of what we put together. You can find the New Yorker Radio Hour anywhere you get your podcasts or on the web at newyorkerradio.org. Thanks, and have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced with help from Trent Williamson, Ed Haber, Caroline Lester, Melissa LaCase, Alicia Allen, Gwendolyn Pointer, Meng-Fei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at zbiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's zbiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.